Well, thank you all very much for coming. This degree of punctuality was never observable when I was here as a professor in the 80s and 90s, so something clearly has changed.
Improved.
As ever, the price is probably too low. That's why so many people come. But we have a very privileged occasion here because Nyree Woods has just produced a book which is of great importance about the IMF and the World Bank. This is the book. I have a copy. I don't know how many of you do, but those of you who don't already have a copy can get a signed copy afterwards for the small sum of $16.99. And with Nyree's signature on it, it will immediately appreciate. So should you ever fall on hard times, you'll have something to fall back on. Nyree is going to speak first, and then Robert Wade and Ken Shadlin. Now, Nyree is the director of the Global Economic Governance Program at Oxford University, has been studying development for many years, and is one of the few people who've written in a scholarly and serious way about the IMF and the World Bank. Robert Wade is another one who's written in a serious and scholarly way and about the IMF and the World Bank. He's Professor of Political Economy here at the LSE. You'll all know Robert. And Ken Shadlin also is here as lecturer in development studies here at the LSE, and also somebody who's thought and written carefully about development and the World Bank and the IMF. I'm not going to be part of the commentators, although I probably won't be able to resist asking a question or two, but I want to be sure that everybody else gets a chance, maybe not everybody, but at least some people get a chance to ask a question or two. So we'll try to get the formal discussion over in an hour, so we'll try and do that by 7:30, and then we'll try and take the last half hour on questions. And there is, of course, as you all know, a good LSE tradition of not dwelling on agreement but focusing elsewhere, so I hope that we'll have a lively discussion. So
can I just add that Nick is another person who has written scholarly work about the World Bank, but not only that, he's been vice president for economics and research at the World Bank, so he has a double connection to the bank.
That's on the public record, but I didn't want to make a big deal of that. We'll have a discussion during the time, and I'll pitch in with a question or two. But your questions and observations are, of course, what comes first. So, Nyree, it's a great pleasure to have you here at the LSE. It's a very important book, and to the extent that you can do justice to a very serious book in half an hour, please have a go.
Thank you. I might just start.
Yes.
Thank you all. It's a real pleasure to be here at the LSE, and actually walking into this lecture theatre tonight, I have to say, reminded me of the very first lecture I ever gave when I was 24 years old, working as a lecturer in the economics department at Auckland University in New Zealand. And I walked into a similarly crowded lecture theatre and began to lecture in microeconomics with what I hoped was a great deal of panache, when suddenly a man at the back of the lecture theatre came running up towards me and demanded to know why I was hijacking his Physics 101 class. And I realised I was in the wrong lecture theatre. So if any of you are not here to hear about the IMF and World Bank, I can quite understand why you might want to slip into another lecture theatre now. The IMF and World Bank 5 or 10 years ago were really at the centre of a storm of adverse publicity. Anti-globalisation protests focused on the two institutions, which over a decade had sort of become the focal point of quite a lot of criticism from a number of different angles, from the left to the right wing of the political spectrum. Indeed, they had become so criticized for what the public perceived as creating poverty, creating environmental damage, causing harm, that when the then president of the World Bank, Jim Wolfensohn, came to Oxford to give a lecture as president of the World Bank, he began his lecture by saying, "It might surprise some of you in the audience to know that I don't wake up every morning trying to think of new ways to kill babies." And then within a year of that lecture, when Michel Camdessous, the then managing director of the IMF, came to Oxford also to give a lecture, the whole building was surrounded by protesters. We had bomb threats. This was the IMF and the World Bank attracting a lot of attention, a lot of negative and critical attention, which put them at the eye of the anti-globalization storm. Today, the IMF and World Bank face something which to some is more disturbing, which is a complete lack of interest. NGOs have shifted some of their focus to other parts of not just development, but the war on terror and other parts of the world. Member governments have shifted their focus to the United Nations, to the Group of 20, to the G8, to the Commission for Africa, to all sorts of forum that lie outside of the IMF and World Bank. But most importantly of all, the IMF's fee-paying clients, the World Bank's main arms fee-paying clients, the borrowers from these organizations, have turned away from them or are turning away from them. And that means that each institution has more than almost ever before got to rethink what it's doing, why it's doing it, and for whom. And that's why tonight, one of the core discussion points is what is the future of these organizations. The book that I've just published, I hope, helps push forward that debate by asking, what are these organizations and how have they become what they are? Because I believe, and I'll present tonight, that if we don't understand that, we can't understand what their future could or should be and how they could step up to the plate to actually fulfill new roles that are being set out for them. The big ideas on the table at the moment for the IMF is that the IMF should now ramp up its surveillance function. It should be the key monitor, if you like, of all economies in the world, looking closely beyond their exchange rates at their whole balance sheets. That's a role that would take objectivity, it would take expertise, and it would take, to quote Britain's governor, ruthless truth-telling, a capacity to do ruthless truth-telling. The World Bank continues its fight against poverty, and now we're told is equaling that fight with a fight against corruption. And again, in trying to work to alleviate poverty and to fight corruption, the institution finds itself in a role where its expertise, its objectivity, its capacity to know what countries can and should do is crucial to its potential success. So do each of these institutions have the requisite expertise, objectivity, and capacity to take on these roles and other roles that we'll come to at the end of my comments? That's the question that I'd like to answer for you this evening. And on the face of it, we should believe that they would have, or at least we might have believed they would have if we go back to when they were born. Born in 1944 and born in a way born free or freer than other international organizations of political influence and of a sort of distortion of what might be their expertise and mission. What do I mean by that? There are four things that made these institutions potentially more independent and more capable of being expert advisors to their members than any other global institutions have ever been. The first was their funding. Their funding would not rely on contributions that governments would make every year. There'd be no US Congress having to approve each allocation. No. The IMF would have a pool of funds automatically put in by each of its members. The World Bank would sell bonds on capital markets to raise its core funding. Neither would be seated with a begging bowl outside the legislatures of its members. Second, each organization would be governed by an executive board, not only resident in Washington, D.C., but with board members who would work first and foremost as officials of the organization, and secondly, as representatives of groups of countries or individual countries. Third, the organizations would have at the head of them a president or a managing director and a management team appointed, yes, by the members, but working independently from them. And fourth, each of these institutions would have a highly trained expert staff, not hired by quotas, not hired by national preferences, but highly trained economists that really could generate the kind of expertise that was needed for them to perform this advisory role. So what happened? And that's really the story of my book. But let me just say as a caveat that any one of you in the audience who's worked in the IMF or in the World Bank will already be probably itching to jump up and say, how on earth can you mention the two institutions in the same sentence? Or as one of my panelists put to me in a panel in Washington, D.C., there have never been two more different institutions, he said. And they are different in many ways. They have different missions, or certainly they should have different missions. For anyone working in one institution, the other does look. For anyone working in the IMF, the World Bank does look curiously undisciplined and open church in its approach and certainly in its publications. For anyone working in the bank, the fund looks particularly hierarchical and disciplined. Inflexible and centralized. All of that's true. But let's not forget, before we get too beholden to this idea that never were two institutions so different, that these institutions, separated by about 10 meters of black asphalt in the middle of Washington, D.C., hire very similarly trained people from very similarly located countries. They have pretty much the same portfolio of borrowing clients. They rely on their borrowing clients for most of their income. And since the 1980s, a good part of each of their missions has been virtually indistinguishable. And that's why, since the 1980s, there's been a constant and ongoing turf war between the IMF and the World Bank on the ground in countries they work, because their work has become so closely intermeshed that it's very difficult for one institution to move without stepping on the other's toes. So I am going to mention them in the same breath at many points tonight, and I'm quite happy for you then to raise in questions what the problems with that are. And there are some problems, I'd be the first to accept that. But I think there are some things which do hold true for both organisations. Let me just simplify the argument of the book by saying that there are three, the book presents three big forces which have shaped the way each of these organisations can use their ostensible objectivity and expertise. In other words, their objectivity, their expertise, and the question of to whom and how they lend have each been deeply affected by these three big forces. The first, simply put, is politics, or in particular, the preferences of their most powerful members. What's interesting is the way that influence was exercised, because as I said, these were institutions born relatively free, although they were headquartered in Washington, D.C., and that's not insignificant. I'll come back to that. But actually, it's when each institution tried to expand that it really became open and porous to particularly American and other creditor countries' strong influence. So it's when the IMF has had negotiations to increase its quota, it's when the World Bank created its IDA, its concessional lending facility, it's when the IMF created special trust funds, and indeed when the World Bank also created special trust funds. It's through these avenues that we see a very sharp political pressure brought to bear, not just on the specific trust fund or the IDA or the specific uses of a quota increase, but on the whole organisation at each of these funding points. Money matters. If you follow the money, you get to a very powerful story of political influence on these institutions. Secondly, the forces are bureaucratic. The fact that each organisation is born with a mission, but put yourself in their seats, you're asked to ensure development in the world or financial stability in the world. How are you going to operationalise that mission? What is it that you're going to do after you've woken up in the morning to actually put into practice that mission? And by tracing through the bureaucratic incentives that each organisation faces, we arrive at some pretty clear explanations for why they've done things the way they've done. Let me take a clear example, the debt crisis. Why in the 1980s, when banks had overlent to countries who had overborrowed, and when the banking system in creditor countries faced collapse, why was the approach taken first by the IMF and then by the World Bank after 1985 as well? One of pushing structural adjustment within each individual country, but not pushing for any international element of a solution. No international bankruptcy mechanism, no international attention to commodity prices, no international attention to exchange rates. Why? I mean, the answer to some of that is very obvious. It's much easier to press a very desperate debtor country individually to tighten their belts and to take measures so as to avoid being cut off from world markets than it is to try to get your powerful creditor members around a table to agree on some modicum of global cooperation or coordination. That's clear. But even once we drill down, we get a story of how it is that the bank on the one hand and the IMF on the other tailored their policies to fit their resources and to fit their bureaucratic needs. In other words, to be able to give clear marching orders to their staff and to be able to be seen to be resolving the debt crisis on limited resources, cutting the clothes to fit the cloth, in other words. And that powerfully affects the kinds of solutions they choose and, terribly importantly, the kinds of solutions that they choose to ignore or discard on their pathway through the 1980s and 90s. And as you'll see, if you do read the book, I think the strategies discarded are as important to look at as the strategies that are actually chosen, because they illuminate for us what's changing about the incentives that each of these bureaucracies face. And thirdly, their relations with borrowing countries. The Fund and Bank, in spite of the wild fantasies that either they or some of their critics might have about them, cannot march into countries and order political change. To work with countries, they require access. They require policymakers to listen to them, to give them information, to come to agreements about what they're going to do, and then actually to put in place those agreements. The relationship they build with individual countries greatly shapes what they do and how they do it. Importantly, it also shapes the politics within each country that they work. And that's an issue that I pick up in three case studies in the book. The first of which is Mexico. It was hugely fun researching the relationship between the IMF and World Bank and Mexico. Because in those good old days when I was beginning the research on this, you couldn't just download all the documents from the web as you can today. No, no. You had to go to Washington and hang around 19th Street and hope to lure some unsuspecting executive director or fund staff member or bank economist into a Starbucks and get the story from them, perhaps even get to read some documents, and then you had to rush down to Mexico City and try and do the same. And I still somewhat regret that more research isn't done in that way, because what you find out, you would never find out off the web, even if all the documents are posted on the web. As I write in my Mexico chapter, I very quickly found out that, for example, one of several IMF missions flying into Mexico City was flying in on tourist visas in disguise. IMF officials in disguise is a fun concept, Hawaiian shirts, whatever. Flying into Mexico City before the budget is announced in order to help the team in the finance ministry put the budget together. And then flying back without anybody noticing they've been there. And then flying in with their suits and ties on 2 days after the budget in order to show that the IMF had had nothing to do with the formulating the budget process. But what I found interesting is what the IMF team didn't know when they flew in on their tourist visas is that a few weeks earlier, the World Bank economist had gone down in a private capacity to help the finance ministry team prepare for their negotiations with the IMF. So you had this sort of layer on layer on layer. But what those layers told me was that there was this relationship of real trust, and it was a tight relationship that had emerged between key policymakers in Mexico and officials within the IMF and within the World Bank. What I was interested in trying to work out is what happens when that kind of relationship emerges. What sort of political space does it create or indeed even distort? And there were three distorting features which disturbed me about it. One, which isn't always disturbing, sometimes it could be seen as a positive effect, but that their close relationship with key officials was tipping the cabinet table. That if you picture all the cabinet ministers sitting around the table, the fact that there are two sitting there with very privileged and secret access to fund and bank disbursements, programs, and so forth, tipped the cabinet table. So that what those people represented as necessary for Mexico to do in order to get loans became what was necessary to do. It took power away from the other voices around the cabinet table, which might, as it were, be arguing for education or health or a different approach to trade. A further effect was that it created it fed into a great short-termism in government. Don't forget, an IMF arrangement is a one-year arrangement. The bank's structural adjustment loans were short-term arrangements. And what this built into government policies was a very short-term time horizon for implementing policies. In Mexico, the Fund and Bank's role was also one of dramatically shaping the economic debate, and that's a role that I also saw very clearly in Russia. I haven't got time to walk you through Russia, which was equally fun to research. But suffice to say, the point I'd like to make about Russia here now is that perhaps the most profound effect that the fund and the bank had in Russia in the 1990s was to polarize the debate about economic policy, to frame the debate as a debate between reformers and non-reformers, when in fact that debate, looked at with hindsight, looks more like a debate between believers and non-believers than a debate between reformers and non-reformers. There were many shades of reform that were possible and debated and argued both outside Russia and inside Russia, yet very, very quickly it became a debate with two very clear poles. You were for it or against it. And I think that that created a legacy for the reform project in Russia that we're still seeing there today. And then to Africa. Why Africa? Africa, in a way, was the hardest test for the bank and fund, because for anyone studying international relations, this is where we would expect them to have the maximum positive effect. In other words, it's in sub-Saharan Africa that each institution is dealing with a country, with countries most needy of their resources, most stretched in their own capacity to generate economic policy and reform ideas, and which were relying on particularly the IMF, but also the World Bank, to be a gatekeeper to other sources of aid and assistance. Put simply, for many African countries, if you look at it from afar, the fund and bank had them over a barrel. So why were they so unsuccessful? Why did their efforts seem to fail at several levels? Why were they so unsuccessful to persuade governments to commit? Why were they then so unsuccessful in having committed governments enact? And why were they so unsuccessful once governments enacted to be able to point to successful outcomes? And it's those issues that I try to work through in the sixth chapter of the book. And again, there are some disturbing facts that come out of that analysis, one of which is that it's precisely in their work in those neediest countries, and here I will need to distinguish the IMF and World Bank. For the IMF, it's precisely in its work in these neediest countries that the organization has deployed its most junior, its least experienced, and its least promoted staff. Those staff have spent the least hours per program than any other program that the organization is entering into. In other words, in its neediest members, I think the institution has failed to step up to the plate. In the World Bank, that's much less true. The bank has gone through periods of putting some of its best and brightest onto, if you like, the Africa brief, although not always in a sustained way. And it's also the case that in interviewing across the organization, there are periods each decade has brought its high priority case. If you were a smart young thing in the bank in the 80s, you wanted to work on Mexico. And if you were a smart young thing in the bank in the early 90s, you wanted to work on Russia. And Africa didn't have its heyday in that period. And that had implications for the quality of work being done at all levels across both organizations on sub-Saharan Africa. But the other thing that stands out when we look at sub-Saharan Africa is the extent to which neither the IMF nor the World Bank, for the two decades that the book really looks at, have focused on what they are uniquely placed to focus on, which is the global part of development failure, the impact of global exchange rate arrangements, the impact of commodity markets, structures, prices, price volatility, the supply side factors on investment and growth. regional infrastructure, the cross-national aspects to why development was failing in these countries, which is not to say, of course, that there were not problems within countries that needed resolution, but it's to say if you asked which organizations were uniquely placed to deal with the international dimension of their problems, it's to the IMF and World Bank that we have to look. So what does all this mean? What does this mean for the institutions looking forward? There are four reasons why the bank and fund now have to change. They're not reasons of justice or effect at all. They're actually just contemporary reasons that their shareholders overall are aware of. The first is the budget pressure. Each organization relies on its income from borrowers. As their large borrowers walk away, they now face a real need to assess where their income's going to come from, how they're going to pay their staff, how they're going to pay their president, their managing director, and what they're going to do with their net income or their earnings. The second is the client disaffection that underpins that walking away. Nowhere is that clearer than in the relationship between Asian countries and the IMF, where Asian countries have simply chosen that post-1997, they will never go to the IMF again in a crisis. They would rather undertake the extraordinarily costly measure of building up their own individual reserves and attempting regional swaps arrangements than go anywhere near the IMF. This is being taken seriously in Washington. People are talking about modest reforms in quota and so forth. That debate is going to have to ratchet up hugely if there is going to be a serious attempt to command the confidence of those Asian economies in the IMF as a multilateral institution. Speaking privately to Asian finance ministers, the story is very clear. They cannot imagine a fund situated in Washington, D.C. that would command their confidence to the degree that they would be prepared to give up their own individual, bilateral, and regional arrangements. But nobody in Washington, D.C. is talking about relocating the IMF to Seoul or to Hong Kong or somewhere else in the world. And yet that's the kind of jump that the debate will have to take if they're going to be serious about the fund at the center of a global exchange rate coordination and a global exchange rate and pooling system for countries' reserves. Both organizations have now accepted that conditionality as it was practiced in the 80s and 90s doesn't work. But what neither of them have come up with is the alternative to conditionality. That means that each is now triply searching, not just for a mission, but for a way to actually undertake their mission in their member countries. What's clear in interviews across their member countries is the gap between what they think they're doing that's of value and what their borrowing members want them to be doing. For example, for 20 years they've been giving policy advice on both macroeconomic policy and microeconomic policy. In every borrowing country I have visited, I've heard the same story, which is we do not want a freshly minted MIT doctorate in economics coming to tell us how to run our economic policy. We want somebody with policy experience. We want somebody that's actually tried to implement economic policy. That's one example. There are other examples in the book and in the brief that goes with the book. I'm aware I'm running out of time here, so let me just point to four ways that I think we could move forward with each institution in order better to prepare it for the kind of mission that each, I think, could play in a world economy to manage globalization. And of course, the book is framed as an argument about managing globalization because that's what the fund and bank were created to do. They weren't created simply to push economic growth, nor were they created to push globalization. They were created to manage the excesses. They were created to manage the process so that there would be even growth of trade and even growth of prosperity. and standards across their membership as well as within each member country. And that's very clearly spelt out in their articles of agreement. So the four things they could do just very quickly. The first is obvious. It's listening to what their clients want. That's obvious. It's what they say. In the last chapter of the book, I try to give meaning to that and say why that, what they would actually need to do if they were to start in on that. It's very obvious that trying to analyze and do research about how monetary policy affects individual African economies while you're sitting in Washington, D.C. and trying to publish in academic economics journals just doesn't work. The IMF has never understood, for example, what the so-called financial transmission mechanism is in any sub-Saharan African country. What that means is that they're telling the country this is what your interest rate should be, but they have no idea what impact that's actually having on savings or investment or anything else going on in the economy. If they really wanted to try to understand that, they would have to be doing research in that country. They would have to start thinking about the way they deploy their staff so that staff would have time enough working on one country to begin to understand that country. And that can't happen if it's this week, Zambia, and next week, Peru. Secondly, the whole debate about conditionality needs dramatically to be simplified. If there's one thing for sure, it's that if you have 100 conditions on a loan, it's an invitation for opportunism on the part of the organisation, i.e. the bank or the fund, and on the part of the borrowing government. Everybody gets into a tactical game. Imagine a world in which conditionality was reduced to one, just one condition, such as transparency on a government's revenue and expenditure, transparency to its own people. The conditionality debate has been pursued as one of streamlining. We're doing this. The evidence so far is that it's not happening. It simply isn't happening. There's still, every loan is loaded with conditionality. The third change, and here I'm finishing off, is to involve their borrowers right from the top of the organization down. That's the governance reforms that the final chapter of the book focuses on. How it is that you can build an incentive into the way the board works in each organization to consult with the borrowing countries. At the moment, there is no such incentive. The G7, if you like, or the creditor countries and the bank can simply keep making policy and keep making decisions, consulting when they want to, but not with a strong incentive to consult and take on board what they're hearing. And finally, it's to refocus the mission of each organization on the international dimension of financial stability and on the international dimension of development assistance. And to focus each on what, not what they're good at, not what they've been doing for 20 years, not what their most powerful shareholder wants them to do, but what it is that they are uniquely placed to do as public multilateral institutions. What is it that they can do that no private sector actor or no individual government or no small grouping of governments can do on their own? I'm going to stop there so we've got time for questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Nari. Now, Robert Wade.
Nairi's central argument has to do with the question, what are the determinants of the effectiveness of these IFIs, the World Bank and the IMF? And as she's indicated, she identifies three major forces which she considers to be determinants of this variable developmental effectiveness. And these forces are sort of brought together through something that she calls the governance structure of these organizations, and the combination of together determines the effectiveness of the organizations in terms of their mission. I'm going to make some rather disparate remarks about this argument, and I'll focus more on what she doesn't say than on what she does say. Beginning with her first major force, which is the preferences of the G7 and especially the G1. And she asked the question of how do the preferences of these powerful states affect the agendas, the operation of the IFIs, and she gave the answer now that the preferences of the powerful states affect these organizations, especially at the time when they try to expand, and that's because they need money in order to expand, and the powerful states are able to put various sorts of conditions on the granting of or access to money. But in the book, Nairi also stresses mechanisms such as education, such as the fact that the great majority of bank economists have PhDs from North America or UK universities. And so there is a very powerful socialization mechanism, which means that the people working in these organizations, even though they may be nationals of India or Brazil or wherever, have gone through the US or UK socialization process and therefore tend to buy into the kind of worldview of the G7 and the G1 states. And when I read this, I was reminded of a debate that must have taken place many times in this room, especially in the 1970s, the debate between Miliband and Poulantzas. I want to now just go off on this radical detour for 1 minute into the Miliband-Poulantzas debate, the point being that Nairi's mechanisms of influence of the G7 over the IMF, the IFIs is very much a sort of Miliband-type mechanism operating through things, as I said, like socialization, education, and the like. Miliband said that you can identify the capitalist character of the bourgeois character of the capitalist state by looking at the origin, the class origin of the senior managers of the state, and he provided plenty of evidence on the class origins of these senior managers. And Poulantzas came back and said, no, that's more effect than cause. The causes of the bourgeois character of the capitalist state are much deeper than that. And so in terms of extending the argument of Nairi's book into the question of the theory of the influence of the G7 states over the IFIs, I do think that there's scope for bringing in the more theoretical literature on empire, on the interstate system, on questions to do with inter-imperialist rivalry versus hegemony, and so on and so on. So that's point number one. There needs to be, there can be, much more theoretical work on this mechanism of preference influence. The second great force that she identifies, relations with borrowing countries. I think that development studies is hamstrung by the dichotomy between advanced countries and developing countries. We need another typology of states, and in the space of 2 minutes, I'm going to suggest a simple typology of developing country states, which I think is useful for understanding this question of the relations between the IFIs and different types of developing country states, not Africa and Mexico and Russia, but different types of states. That will help us lift the discussion to a more theoretical level. The first great distinction to make is simply whether there is a organizational and normative separation between the public and private realms. This is Weber's rational legal state. And if the answer is no, there's no clear separation between the public and the private realms, then we have a neo-patrimonial state. And if the answer is yes, then we have one of two other types of states. And the distinction between these two has to do with whether state authority is highly concentrated and the social base of the state is very narrow, or whether state authority is fragmented and the social base of the state is very plural. And if it is the former, namely highly concentrated state authority and narrow social base of the state, we have a cohesive capitalist type of state, such as in East Asia. And if the concentration of state authority is rather little, if it's fragmented, and the social base of the state is
broad, then we have a fragmented multi-class state, such as in Mexico and much of Latin America, for example. And the point of all this is that the effectiveness of the IFIs in carrying out their mission depends very much on the nature of the state that they are dealing with. It will be much more difficult for the IFIs to carry out their mission when they're dealing with neo-patrimonial states than when they are dealing with cohesive capitalist states, with the fragmented multi-class states somewhere in the middle. In any case, that's an idea which I think is worth more attention. And the final big force is what she calls the bureaucratic force. And here I just make one point. There's a strange absence in the book, to my mind, about the relevance of organizational structure for development effectiveness. What I mean is this. As Nairi said in her remarks just now, and I think many people would agree, the effectiveness of these organizations partly depends upon their ability, the ability of staff, to build up what Clifford Geertz called thick knowledge of particular countries and particular regions. And that requires a sustained interaction between staff members, a particular staff members or set of staff members, and a particular country. And the extent to which this buildup of thick knowledge is possible is a function of, amongst other things, organizational structure. Now, the World Bank has gone through four major organizational structures since 1972, and each of them has changed the balance between giving priority to country knowledge, as in thick knowledge, on the one hand, or priority to technical knowledge in the sense of an irrigation specialist, a forestry specialist, a macroeconomic economist should be able to go anywhere in the world and apply this specialty. That's a very different kind of organization than one where country knowledge is given preference. And the point is that the 1987 organizational structure of the bank gave much more weight to country knowledge, thick knowledge, than the structure that was put in place in 1997, which gave more emphasis to sort of universal technical knowledge. So that's that impact of organizational structure on the effectiveness of the bank in carrying out its, and the bank and the fund in carrying out their missions, I think is an area that is worth looking at. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Robert. Ken Shadland, please.
Great. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I lecture in this room regularly, although I usually don't have Nick Stern introducing me. But it's nice to see so many familiar faces as well. Nairi, congratulations on a fantastic book, a timely book, and an important book that people will purchase and read and enjoy for years. Seriously. I have a few remarks. I'll make sure that I'm done by 25 after 7:30 at the very latest, so we can leave plenty of time for Nairi to answer questions. It is, after all, her evening. I want to start off with you framed the remarks at the beginning, and you came back to it about sort of the question of the current relevance or potentially irrelevance of these international institutions. You bring up four things at the end about they have declining income. They have declining demand for their loans, there's declining effectiveness of their conditions, and there's declining legitimacy of their policy advice. And essentially, these four sort of factors lead to sort of new challenges for the bank and the fund. And what I'm wondering is how much this is actually very new. I mean, if we were having the same conversation 30 years ago, we could basically be saying the same things. Well, I wouldn't have been saying the same things 30 years ago, but people who were studying this in this position would have been saying similar same things. In the 1970s, the income of the bank and the fund, particularly relative to the borrowing needs of the countries, was very small. Post-oil shock, countries needed to borrow a lot of money. The demand for their products was very small because those that could borrowed from Wall Street instead. So this is sort of the rise of international bank loans to the developing world. There were raging debates over conditionalities. Are the things that the bank, and particularly the fund, have been telling these countries to do or encouraging these countries to do since created in the late 1940s, are they working? Are they good for development? And the policy advice, again, was very contentious. Should the bank and the fund's conditionality be geared towards growth, or should it always be sort of constrained by sort of preserving the institution's resources? So in many ways, there's very similar challenges. And I bring this up not just sort of to be clever and make a historical analogy, but because in addition to a sort of analogous sort of set of factors coming together, we're having the discussion now in a period that's similar in terms of an external environment, in that international financial markets right now are completely flush, and banks and investors are dying to lend money to developing countries. But that changed in the 1970s, and that will change again. I don't know when it will change again. Maybe it'll change in 2006. Maybe it'll change in 2010. But there'll be a time in which basically the creditors who are now rushing, the same creditors who are basically dying for Latin American countries, Argentina, that 5 years ago they said they would never lend to again, are dying for them to issue bonds, that will basically be scared away, just in the same way that the same creditors in 1977 couldn't lend enough money to developing countries by the early 1980s, couldn't get out fast enough. And so what I'm wondering is how the particularly my commentary about the fund, how the fund will reinvent itself this time. And the reason why I think this is an important question to ask is that a lot of the things that the fund, from my reading, did to reinvent itself in the 1980s, when it seemed like it had faced a crisis of relevance, it was being underutilized, as the language of the time was, I believe. A lot of its solutions then are today's problems in many ways, sort of the massive expansion of the structural adjustment lending, the huge loans that it started to give to countries way beyond sort of what it traditionally had been allowed to give and so on. And so the question then is whether today's solutions will become tomorrow's problems. I think there's always a tendency to say that, you know, organizations basically face these crisis times in which events force change, and the change that they're going to make is necessarily going to be a good change. But it's actually possible that the way that the bank and the fund might react to today's sort of the confluence of these factors, low demand for its loans, low income, et cetera, could actually make things worse rather than better, a cause for sort of more pessimism than optimism. Another point I wanted to make is I think that the point that you make about sort of tipping the table, to use your phrase, is a great point, and it's a completely correct point. And it goes to show how these organizations are very political organizations, political not just in the way that we often think that these organizations are political and that they respond to political interests, but they're political in that they affect policymaking and politics in the borrowing countries. Countries negotiating, there's a set of policy ops or routes they might go down. Each one has different implications or different sets of winners, different sets of losers. And if basically the fund can sort of, and the bank can influence things in one way rather than the other way because of their sort of their expertise and the fact that the two people who are sitting around the table at the cabinet meeting in Mexico City are more important than the other people sitting on the table because they have these connections to Washington and to the bank and the fund, that affects policy and subsequent politics in countries. I think actually that it's political even that putting it that way, actually understates how political these organizations are. Because the Mexico scenario, for example, is taking place in a country that at the time was hyper-presidentialist and the legislature was meaningless. So essentially all they had to do was tip the table around the executive branch and they'd get the deal done. But another scholar who's written on this topic, James Vreeland, he's shown actually the way that this sort of power can, the fund particularly, has power to influence domestic politics within countries, not just through the expertise and the knowledge that it sort of gives to certain people and makes some people's ideas and economic prescriptions seem more persuasive than the other people sitting on the table, but because it can take options off the table. And the example that he gives, it doesn't require a presidential system. In a divided government, some people want to sign an agreement with the fund, some people don't want to sign an agreement with the fund. The key thing, however, is that the fund only will negotiate with the executive. it's hard to imagine an alternative to that, but that's what it does. It's right, it makes a negotiation with the executive. So if the president or the prime minister wants to negotiate with the fund, those who are opposed to the agreement, they don't have the option anymore of saying, we oppose, because opposing the agreement doesn't exist. Now that the status quo has been removed. What they're choosing between is going along with the agreement or opposing an agreement that has already basically been negotiated, that the financial press has reported, and that the local and international financial markets have gotten excited about. So what you're choosing between is basically perhaps going along with an agreement that you don't like or creating a situation which might actually be even worse than the agreement that you are opposed to. And the reason why I'm going into this is just because I think it is completely complementary to Nairi's point, but it shows that this power to sort of redirect domestic politics isn't just based on knowledge, but it's based on just the fact that the fund negotiates with the executive. And again, I personally can't imagine an alternative to that, but I know people will disagree with that. And the last point that I want to make, and here I know that we are on complete agreement, but I'd like to get you sort of to push you a little bit further on how we would sort of take this forward. And this is where, Nairi, when you write and you speak about sort of getting the organizations to specialize more in the things that they should be good at, sort of their global mandates. Okay. And I think this is a long-term problem that these organizations have had. Again, most of my comments, I keep on saying the bank and the fund, particularly the fund, because I'm more familiar and have done more sort of work on the fund than the bank. So I don't know that. I'm not as good of an authority on the bank. But it's a long-standing sort of challenge to get the IMF to focus on sort of what you might regard as the structural causes of the need for its resources, the structural causes of borrowing. Why is it that some countries are more likely than other countries, all else being equal, to basically go and want to borrow money from the IMF? And that's because there's this long-standing sort of line of reasoning which says because there's some countries, because of the way that they're sort of situated into the international economy, are more prone to external shocks, in terms of trade shocks, financial shocks, and so on. And how can we get the fund to sort of take these particular problem of commodity producers, for example, into account in designing its policies and providing its economic advice? And I think that I often have a conversation with students on this topic in which I suggest, sort of to play the devil's advocate, if you think what developing countries should do is, if they think the IMF is such a big bad wolf, then basically stop trying to reform the fund, stop complaining about it, just avoid the fund. Don't have any balance payments crisis, keep your macroeconomic situation under control, and then you don't have to deal with it, and then you don't have to take its policy advice. And I throw this out there to try to start a debate or a discussion about what other people have written about, sort of the high cost of doing this. So, as Nairi points out, the self-insurance that a lot of East Asian countries are undertaking, sort of the hoarding of foreign reserves, is costly. It may not be very desirable, but furthermore, it's probably not even possible. Some countries can probably protect themselves from these terms of trade shocks and financial shocks, but most developing countries probably just can't do it. So the idea that says sort of keep your house in order and then you don't have to deal with the fund is probably not practical. It's probably not a practical sort of piece of advice. And the point of this then is that this gets to sort of taking sort of the structural challenges that developing countries face, the reason why there are sort of structural sort of determinants or demand for borrowing from the fund, taking these more seriously. And I know that we're in agreement on this because you want the IMF sort of looking forward to sort of go down that route and take these issues more seriously. I badly do as well. And what I'd like to hear a bit more is about sort of how we could actually get the organization to do this, because this isn't a new problem, something that came up in 2006. This has basically been the debate that's been raging for as long as developing countries have been borrowing about the fund and wanting to basically get more money with fewer conditions. But again, congratulations on an excellent book, and thanks for inviting me to participate.
Thank you very much to all of you for being disciplined. We were aiming for 7:30. It's now 7:30, so that gives us half an hour for discussion. in order to be to give the maximum number of people a chance to ask a question, could you try to make them as brief as possible, please? A gentleman in the front row. Please. Yeah, there's a mic coming around.
Thank you all for your presentations. Dr. Wood, on the question of the role of IFF, the role of international financial institutions in seeking an international solution to, say, the debt crisis that you referred to, because of the SDRM that has been withdrawn or, so to speak, put on the ice by the IMF, the sovereign debt restructuring mechanism that was supposed to seek a solution to international bankrupt solutions, do you think this represents those preferences of G7 or G1, for instance, when a contractual solution is favored over, say, a statutory solution that is proposed by IMF? Do you think this represents those conflicts? And how, in your opinion, do you think when the preferences of, say, the World Bank or the IMF are in contrast, say, with those of the G7, how do you think those conflicts should be resolved?
Thank you. I'll take them in blocks of three and then give the panel a chance to respond, please.
Maria Almendra McBride from Grupo Promomedios, USA in Spanish and Mexico. You know, I kept thinking way back when I was in Mexico City and I could buy for the equivalent of the exchange to the dollar, 12 pesos 50, 1 kilogram of beefsteak and still have left for 12 eggs to cook in the morning. Now, this relates to my question. Do all these experiments and formulae and initials and, you know, high-voluted officials that negotiate with executives and whatnot, do they remember that underneath it all there are people, there's a population that you are actually, you know, making an experiment with? So my question is, do you think the earthquake you cause with all these, you know, economics and policies by foreigners placing them abroad, which is like in Mexico, but you know, you would be foreign for us over there, is actually what causes tsunamis like Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales and this reaction of what the people really want and really need and have really, you know, asked for, which is, you know, just don't crush us with your formulas. It's amazing. We haven't been able to subsist the middle class. We're being crushed for the sake of formulas and policies here. You know, it's amazing. Please remember the people underneath.
Thank you. Gentleman in the back, rather.
Since, 1999, there's been a turn towards participation and empowerment and engagement with civil society organizations, evident in the World Bank and also IMF literature. Do you think this is a turn towards real democracy in the way that the institutions work, or is it cosmetic, or is it just a way of incorporating the opposition to their policies? What's your opinion, please?
Thank you very much. So we'll take those three questions now. Nari, can you start?
Right. So the first question was about why the idea for an international bankruptcy mechanism, the SDRM, the Sovereign Debt Restructuring Mechanism, failed in the IMF. And it's a very good question. Let me just briefly say, you know, we can ask, why was the IMF keen to do this after a decade and a half of running away from any such idea? And I think that there really was a logic which was different to the US Treasury logic, which is that the IMF was facing larger and larger financial crises with smaller and smaller amounts of money. In Korea, it just couldn't put enough money on the table to make a difference. And so it sought a different way of dealing with financial crises. It sought to have some legal power over the resolution of a debt crisis. And that very quickly ran into objections from its major shareholders. It also ran into very quick objections from its borrowing countries, from emerging markets, who were afraid that any such mechanism would reduce their capacity to borrow in the short term, even if there were some in some of those countries that could see a long-term interest. I felt that the the bankruptcy mechanism being thought about in the late 1990s was a bit like trying to work out how to fight the last war. That in the 1980s, you really needed it. In the 1980s, the IMF and World Bank really did operate as debt collectors for private international banks who sat on the edge of collapse. And that had huge costs for borrowers. And they've come away from that position now. But I think the argument for some kind of international workout resolution procedure goes on and needs to go on. And I think the private sector agree they have a collective action problem. The borrowing governments agree that they have a short-term versus long-term problem. But it's hard to see how the politics will ever configure, I think, to come up with a solution.
Gentlemen.
Shall I answer the...
I'm very sorry.
Right. So the second question was about Mexico and about what are the impacts on people of these kind of sky-high experiments. And I just wanted to say to that one of the things that really struck me as somebody going just to visit your country, if you are from Mexico, right, going to visit your country, was that in December of 1994, Mexico had a dramatic financial crisis. And about a year or two later, the view in Washington and New York was that it had weathered the crisis and that Mexico is now doing very well. As a visitor to Mexico, what really struck me is that up until December of 1994, as you know, a female walking alone in the streets of Mexico City, I felt totally safe, even at 2 o'clock in the morning. After December of 1994, that was never, ever again the case. There was something in that crisis that fractured the society and that gave leash to a whole criminality which has been subsequently impossible to restrain, so that security in Mexico City is still an issue for every Mexican that lives there today. And I think that that's the kind of issue that you're absolutely right to focus our attention on. And it's something that the economic statistics on Mexico don't reveal, but other kinds of data can reveal. And thirdly, the participation and empowerment agenda, what impact do I think it's having? Very limited. The independent evaluation of the fund have actually done a study, as have the bank's evaluation department, of these efforts. It's certainly true that, and as many of you will know, when the IMF and World Bank got into doing debt relief, that's to say reducing the amount that countries had to pay, the quid pro quo pushed by Western NGOs was that they really make sure that any savings that countries made were used to reduce poverty. And so was born a very uncomfortable instrument, because this HIPC instrument is supposed to do two things at once. On the one hand, it's supposed to deliver very rapid debt relief. And on the other, it's supposed to encourage participatory forms of consultation and economic policy making in each of these countries. One's a very short-term goal, one is a very long-term goal, and unsurprisingly, the result has been very mixed. The result on the ground is that in a few countries there has been opening up, there has been more participation, but overwhelmingly what's happened with the PRSP process is that it's added simply another layer of bureaucracy, really, of bureaucratic hoops that are written in Washington, applied in country, and if anything, critics would say, are increasing the presence of donors and the fund and the bank on the ground. My very simple image of the participation debate and where it can go wrong is that you can now travel to many capitals in sub-Saharan Africa and find a small room absolutely stuffed full of international development assistance community people, the UNDP, the IMF, the World Bank, DFID, and they're all busy arguing about which one of them will lead the country-led strategy. And it strikes me as the kind of perverse outcome of every one of these donors trying to do participation on the ground.
I understood it from what you were saying. You were saying that the reason why the IMF World Bank in the 80s and in the 90s made a sort of problem definition focused on the domestic rather than the global and international was because of bureaucratic politics in the organizations and the bureaucrats' unwillingness to confront the problems of trying to bring the disparate forces in the world together on a common conception of what was going on and what needed to be done on a global scale. I took that to be your argument. The problem with this argument is that actually, if you look across the international institutions, for example, if you look at the United Nations and its economic functions, what you find in the 80s and then especially in the early 90s is that it did have a number of institutions that were focusing on the global and the international dimension and seeking to give support to weaker states and weaker economies and strengthen their capacities to tackle the international situation. One thinks of UNCTAD and the Center on Transnational Corporations and so on. And you find a massive pressure coming down to scrap those roles at the beginning of the 90s, and a united pressure from the powerful states to scrap those roles. And you see across all kinds of policy fields this common, massive switch to making the problem definition the domestic arrangements. You see it in peacekeeping and all that kind of thing, and you see it in economics as well. And surely it's that, rather than bureaucratic politics and the IMF and World Bank, that we're seeing going on.
So upstairs, a lady in green, and then a lady in red at the back.
Hello. Mirror. Hi, thank you for your presentation. I've not as yet had a chance to read your book, but I will definitely. As far as I can tell, you talk about you have a debate on the effectiveness on the organization, etc., of these organizations on the one hand. And on the other hand, you're pointing out the failures that they've encountered to deal with things like bankruptcy, etc. And then this got me thinking whether, you know, you're talking about global governance or international governance, which brought me to think about the Basel Accords as an alternative form of regulating the financial system that we're living with today. So with this in mind, I would like to know, do you think it's the continuous failure of these organizations to deal with so many international problems suggests that perhaps under the current status quo, we're simply not ready for global governance, even in the financial sphere of globalization? And perhaps a connecting question is that, do you think that in a globalized 21st century, has much changed in terms of governance, especially in finance? Thank you.
Hello?
Yeah.
Emma Maudsley from Birkbeck College. Will Wolfowitz lead the World Bank towards any or none of your suggestions? I wondered if you'd give us a candid opinion. Or should we perhaps Robert Wade, be thinking of EMPA?
Yeah, you can answer those. The first question was in the end about why no collective strategy on the part of developing countries, I think. And I think that's an extremely important point. And it certainly is there in the book. You know, if debtors had somehow collectivized in the 80s, you would have had a very, very different outcome from the debt crisis. If they were able collectively to press their case on lots of these issues, you would end up with different outcomes. And so I think you're absolutely right that there is a pressure. There's a contradiction in the current aid debate about wanting to empower countries but not wanting to empower them enough so that in negotiations they hold an upper hand. And I think that's part of what those collective strategies feed into. The second question was about global versus international governance. On that, I think, I hope I conveyed in my remarks that I think the bank and fund need to work first on the international, that's to say cooperation and coordination among member governments. Obviously, with a conversation and transparency to global civil society, to national civil societies, to subnational civil societies, which keeps them honest and keeps them doing their job. Global governance, I think, has come to mean a kind of different, a new kind of Washington consensus, right? It's a consensus that's forged in capitals of the G7 and pushed as a set of technical solutions, whether it's a solution to HIV/AIDS or education or, you know, you name it. So I am very skeptical of the moves to global governance, which seem to me to be an attempt to make up for the fact that international governance has often failed. I think first we need to work the international governance out, because without that, global governance becomes technical one-off solutions, all of which we've seen before, which don't work because there's no political accountability and sustainability behind them. And third was Wolfowitz and where he's going to lead the World Bank. And I'm sure that the chair of this panel would be able to give us a more interesting and up-close answer, and I would encourage him, of course, to do so. But what strikes me is that that there are some very clear dilemmas in the mission that Wolfowitz has given himself in the World Bank. You know, one of which is to fight corruption robustly everywhere, and the other of which is to increase loans to big borrowers, and in particular for infrastructural projects. And the third of which, not a spoken aim, but which is to continue the quest to ensure that American companies, you know, benefit to some degree from World Bank contracts, which has always been part of the mission of at least 6 or 7 different federal agencies. And I think all those things are running in tandem, and they're already running into some rather uncomfortable clashes in the bank. But I think the really big problem that was raised when Wolfowitz took the job, which is not about Wolfowitz himself as an individual, you know, he's obviously an extremely intelligent, you know, subtle thinker and so forth. It's the fact that this is a multilateral institution paid for by its borrowers, right, which needs the confidence of all of its membership if it's going to succeed as a multilateral institution. And the optic of appointing somebody who the rest of the world sees very much as the voice and policy of the American administration, I just think is problematic. And he's done a lot to try to dispel that, the sort of going around and listening stuff. But that's not affecting, in any of the countries that I visit, the basic optic, which is that this underscores for many people in many parts of the world that the World Bank is an American institution. And I think that's a real problem for the bank generally, but for the bank at this particular moment, I think it's a really big problem.
On this, on the point about Wolfowitz, 90% of World Bank staff responded negatively when they were asked about their evaluation of Wolfowitz when he was nominated to be president. 90%. So he came in knowing that he had a rather hostile kind of reception. One year on, I was in Washington just very recently at the bank. One year on, I think it's fair to say that there is great uncertainty in the minds of senior bank managers, not to say lower down staff, as to what Wolfowitz wants beyond this emphasis on anti-corruption, on infrastructure. And by the way, I do myself strongly support the increase in bank attention to infrastructure investment. And the third thing is Africa. Africa is a big one of his big priorities. Beyond that, even the vice presidents don't have much of a clue about his strategy for the bank. But I think you can say he's not, in a kind of gross, blatant way, making it more of an instrument, an agent of the US administration than it was before. whatever that's worth.
Nari's pushing me to say something. Two remarks on perspective. One, the World Bank is a small institution in terms of its relationship with the world. It lends $15-16 billion a year. Investment in developing countries is about 100 times that, about $1.5 trillion a year. If you look at its education lending, it would be a couple of billion dollars a year. It fluctuates, but around that sort of level. Spending on education in developing countries would be of the order of $250 billion a year. I had this, in order to bring my colleagues at the World Bank down a little bit on the humility scale, I used to draw attention to the 1% rule. You know, they're about 1% of what goes on. So you have to be very careful not to overdo it as to what kind of influence they have. They can have influence at particular times, and they're not small in relation to Africa. But elsewhere in the world, on the whole, the World Bank is small. The second is, if you think about what's been happening in development over the last 30 or 40 years, it is very important to recognize that what we've seen at that time is a quite extraordinary increase in life expectancy. It's gone from the mid-40s to the mid-60s over the last 30 or 40 years. And we've seen an extraordinary reduction in illiteracy. It's gone from maybe half of the population in the developing world being illiterate in that time to maybe a quarter. So it is very important to recognize that the whole story of development is not one that's driven largely by the World Bank and the IMF. And it is one that in a very major way, just on the two dimensions I've described, has seen extraordinary change. So I think it's very important to get that perspective when you're discussing the role of these institutions. And Africa over the last 5 years has seen income per capita grow at roughly the same rate of the rest of the developing world, if, it's a big if, you net out India and China, 4-5% per annum over the last 5 years or so. So it's not a story, it's not a development story of total disaster, and I think that's very important to recognize. At the same time, of course, the experience of Africa over the 20 years from the late 70s to the late 90s was very tough indeed, and that is something which should be a big part of the development story as well. But I think that perspective is a very important one. On the question of empowerment, which was raised a little while ago, I think we mustn't just see this in terms of empowerment of countries relative to the World Bank and the IMF. I think we should see it in terms of the empowerment of individuals. And one thing I think, one reason why that started to gather pace, at least in terms of interest in the World Bank and the IMF, was the focus on poverty at in the last 15 years or so, which brought with it, I think, a much more serious attempt to try to understand what poverty meant. It's not just an income level and a price index and then looking at the number of people below that income level standardized the price index. It's much more than that. It's about the ability of people to shape their own lives on all sorts of dimensions, on education of their children, what happens to them when they get sick, and so on. So I think part of the empowerment story in terms of an understanding of what the objectives of the World Bank should be, I don't think the IMF have got this yet, they may never, but the as far as the World Bank's concerned, I think a focus on empowerment of individuals came from an extended focus on poverty and trying to understand what that really meant, because that's not something that you get, at least not until recently, in a graduate course at MIT or elsewhere. You've been getting at LSE for a long time, of course, is the story. So I think those perspectives are very important. Now, what about Wolfowitz? First, I should draw your attention to the statement on page 380 of the report of the Commission for Africa which I spent much of the previous year writing, it says that the president of the of the World Bank and the managing director of the IMF should be selected without any restriction on the country from which the candidate comes, according to who is the best place to do the job. I think that's right. The 17 members of the Commission for Africa, including the Prime Minister Gordon Brown and Hilary Benn, signed up to that, and so did Michel Condisou, who was a preceding member of the IMF, managing director of the IMF. And I feel very strongly that that would send a very powerful signal as to the character of those institutions. So I think that's of fundamental importance, and that by itself would do a great deal. Now, you don't just solve problems of institutions by changing their heads, but if you want to make a very clear statement, this is a multilateral institution, then I think it would be a very valuable step forward. That still doesn't ask the question of where Mr. Wolfowitz is going. I think that the major issues like Africa and growth and infrastructure, which Nari and Robert pointed to, are important strategic senses of direction that are strong. But I think there should be much greater emphasis than we've seen hitherto on getting results on scale. That means that really delivering on the promises of 2005. And the World Bank obviously needs to scale up its own actions, but above all, and here I agree very strongly with Nari, it needs to help lay the international foundations in a country for outside support to be genuinely support for where the country itself is going, and to establishing a long-term relationship. And I think that narrow emphases on corruption, as opposed to investing in better governance, which is about capacity and accountability, I think that that excessive emphasis on corruption is a problem. And I do hope that that will be broadened out into a much stronger and more constructive approach on governance. And that means creating the conditions under which corruption is much less likely, which is after all, is the systemic response. At the same time, I think showing a very careful awareness of your own responsibilities in the use of public money, it is fine. But the problem is if it drowns out the much bigger question of creating an environment where corruption, or supporting the creation of an environment where corruption is much less likely. So I think getting results on scale and really taking on board the governance agenda, and in a way which helps build long-term partnerships in the way that Nari is describing, is very important. I think he's an intelligent man, and he listens. Heeding and listening are not the same thing, but I do believe in the virtue, indeed the obligation, of consistently putting good arguments and assembling the evidence, and I think that's what outsiders, which I am, should do. Well, let's do three very fast, and then that'll be the end. One here, please.
Linda Corsha, you've talked a lot about in-country corruption just there, but I'm quite surprised, really, at the lack of focus on the relationship between IFIs and the needs of transnational capital, and cross-referencing with the trade agenda. That's one point that I want to raise, because it doesn't seem to have had very much.
Can we take just the one point, because we're right?
Well, this is the main point I want to make.
Okay.
There's a very strong lack of. In the IFIs, of taking account of the gendered nature of poverty, and in fact they can clearly be seen with, for instance, structural adjustment programs to have exacerbated that. I wanted to ask Dr. Woods whether you looked at that at all, or you came across those issues of gender in your work, and what's the chance, do you think, of gender equity conditionality as a shift in addressing poverty?
lady there. Lady in the scarf just there, please.
Yeah, thank you very much for your presentation. My question is regarding democracy as a determinant of the effectiveness of the World Bank interventions and funding. My question is directed to Dr. Wirtz and Professor Wade as well, because he pointed out something very important, which is the nature of the states that the World Bank and the IMF are dealing with. So my question is, what is the role of democracy, the lack of democracy or the presence of democracy, not only in the countries that the World Bank and IMF are dealing with, but also within the World Bank structure, and how do they affect the effectiveness of the funding of the World Bank? Thank you very much.
Last question, gentleman right up there at the back.
Thank you.
It's coming.
The image that IMF has among developing countries, as rightly described by a big bad wolf. And if it is big bad wolf, or even partly so, what I'm asking is what gains developing countries can have from IMF? I mean, why should they support IMF if what you call, it is at all, the big bad wolf? Thank you.
Robert, very quickly, and then we'll leave the last words to Nari.
No, Nari can get it.
Nari.
On gender and the question of gender, there's obviously a justice case for looking at the gender effects of what different institutions do, but I think in development assistance, there's an effectiveness case that's just absolutely obvious and there. If you look at the evidence that has been assembled about if you direct development assistance to women in a society, the outcomes that you get from that assistance, it's pretty extraordinary. And there's an effectiveness story there that as aid agencies strive to work out how to make their aid effective, they need to take up seriously. So I think the gender dimension is very important. I'd like to see more people making the argument in terms of effectiveness, because I think that that's where it really has bite. On democracy and the role that the World Bank and the IMF could play in perhaps fostering democracy, sadly, I sort of didn't think I would live to see the day when conditionality would look like the soft option for democratization and military invasion would look like the alternative. And I think it's a philosophical question. I don't believe that that's how you generate sustainable democracy in countries. I think that what the IMF and World Bank can contribute to is an environment of accountability, whether a government is democratic according to our definition or somebody else's. I think the most important contribution they should make is trying to make sure that that government is accountable to its own people. And that's why, if there's one condition that I think is worthwhile thinking about, it's the accountability to people on a government's revenue and on a government's expenditure. And then the big bad wolf. Why would developing countries want to, you know, should developing countries get together and simply walk out from the IMF completely? The thing is that if we look at what I've described this evening as the international dimension of the development challenge, we find a whole lot of genuinely international obstacles for any country trying to foster, you know, growth, equity, poverty alleviation within its own borders. And that's where I think we do need multilateral institutions. I think it's been clear from my remarks tonight that I don't think that the IMF or the World Bank, structured in the way they are currently structured, can deliver what developing countries need from them. But that doesn't mean that I think they should be abolished. I think that now is it actually a very propitious moment to push for a different agenda for them. Earlier, one of my panelists talked about exit and voice. And when the very important emerging markets, and particularly the Asian economies, exit from the fund, it's got a problem, right? It has to start thinking about, and its powerful shareholders have to start thinking about how they need to change the institution. So, you know, I have to end by saying I'm pathologically optimistic. You know, I'm just not a believer in ripping buildings down. I'm a great believer in how we can make them better, and I think these could be much better institutions, and they could deliver much better value to their developing country members. But that does require some pretty dramatic reform.
Nari, thank you all. Thank you all very much for coming, and thank you, Nari, for leading a really splendid discussion, and to Robert and Ken. And the books are outside at $16.99, worth much more with Nari's name handwritten inside them. So thank you all very much for coming.